On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a showdown in Washington, a collision course over the prosecutor firings, a constitutional crisis looming, and both sides are swinging. President Bush fires a shot over the bow.
We will not go along with a partisan fishing expedition aimed at honorable public servants.
But Democrats say they want the truth. Here's Senator Charles Schumer of New York.
If there's nothing to hide, nothing wrong with a transcript, what is the objection to an oath? If there's nothing to hide and everyone's telling the truth, there should be no objection to oath.
Both sides are rattling their legal sabers, subpoenas on the one hand, executive privilege on the other. Congress claims its right to make Karl Rove and others talk under oath, but the administration asserts its right to shield them. It's uncharted territory for this tight-lipped White House and newly emboldened Democrats. This hour on Point, Congress, the White House, and the escalating test of wills. In a moment, we'll be joined by two of the country's top constitutional scholars, Professor Lawrence Tribe of the Harvard Law School and Douglas Kamek of Pepperdine University. But we begin in Washington now with Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Gail.
Good morning. How are you?
And tell us what the latest developments are.
Well, I think you cast it very well. This is careening toward what could be the first major constitutional crisis of this second term. The Senate Judiciary Committee meets this morning. The House Judiciary Committee met yesterday. And they're looking toward setting up sworn testimony with transcripts in public under oath. There is no more highly charged congressional scene than that. I think the administration has very much the experience of Scooter Libby on their minds. They don't want to see a wide-ranging investigation under oath that could lead to perjury down the line on minutia that may or may not be directly related to what starts out. That's why the White House is so concerned about sworn testimony at this time and in this climate.
Scooter Libby, of course, the Vice President Cheney's former top aide who was recently convicted. Take us back for a moment, Gail, and explain to us why the House authorized subpoenas and what it means.
Well, they authorized subpoenas rather than issuing them. It is a first step, and it gives the Judiciary Chairman, John Conyers, more room to negotiate with the White House over getting facts out. He wants top White House aides to testify directly and in public. The White House doesn't want to do it. Now, the Senate is likely to take an even stronger position. Just before this morning's hearings, Chairman Leahy said that, in his view, the White House had given up on negotiations when they said that the deal would be off the table the minute subpoenas were issued. That is something that he finds is unacceptable.
Authorizing subpoenas and issuing subpoenas might be two different things, though. Do you think that Congress will actually get to the point where it issues subpoenas to Karl Rove, Harriet Myers, others in the White House?
I do, yes. This is becoming a very intense politically at this point. It's interesting on the Senate side that initially Senator Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, wasn't leading the charge on this. This was left to Charles Schumer, a Democrat from New York, who is also the head of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee. This led to immediate response by Republicans saying Democrats are trying to politicize this issue. But now Senator Leahy is also wanting to get ahead of this issue. So anytime you have two powerful, very savvy Democrats both fighting to lead the issue, it doesn't look to me as if anyone's going to back down anytime soon. It's too important, and it touches on issues on which Democrats are completely united. Unlike the rest of the agenda right now, the war, budget, immigration, education, the issues we thought would be the flashpoints, this is an issue no one expected, but it's one on which Democrats are absolutely united.
Is that why Democrats smell blood in the water? What's the game plan politically?
Well, they have two issues they're thinking about. One is pursuing justice. There's almost no issue that resonates the American public and their own base more than the idea that someone is trying to politically manipulate how justice is administered. And that came out in the testimony of several of the fired attorneys, one who felt that he was being pressured to push indictments against Democrats before an election, and another who felt that he was being pushed to investigate voter fraud where he felt there was no evidence for it. Those are very top issues in the thought of public, especially the Democratic base. But on the other hand, Democrats want to show they can govern. They want to actually produce legislative results. That requires working with Republicans, and it requires the president signing something. But there's another part that doesn't want to see a train wreck just the first quarter of the second term.
Well, given those two conflicting scenarios, is there a feeling of inevitability here? You seem to certainly paint one.
Well, you never say inevitable, not when there is still time to talk. What I'm looking for is time, and I think that is the one promising thing that came out of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. By not issuing a subpoena, by just authorizing one, they were saying, we're going to give you some more time to work this out. Republicans are very concerned about it. You're already hearing top people like Adam Putnam on the House side, who he's almost a litmus for for where the party is headed, expressing real concerns about Gonzales, that he has to be straight when he speaks to Congress. There can be no more misstatements, misrepresentations of what went on. But if he's honest, he thinks he can get through that. And that's the key at this point. A lot of this is on the Attorney General's shoulders. Can he make up for some of the misstatements when this began? And can he lay out an account of what went on that is credible?
What are you, where's the White House going with this? Do you sense that the White House and Attorney General Alberto Gonzales are going to dig in further?
Well, they will, but there's an aspect to this that interested me very much. When you look closely at what the president said last night, when he talked about the documents he's going to be releasing, he said there'll be anything between the White House and the Justice Department concerning these firings, and also anything between members of Congress and the White House concerning these firings. Now, that's very interesting, because there have been Democrats as well who had objections to some of these fired U.S. attorneys, especially Diane Lamb in California. Senator Feinstein had expressed reservations about how aggressively she was going after immigration. Members of Congress don't want to see their emails on the front page of the New York Times either. And I'm wondering if there isn't a little wiggle room at that point with the White House talking to members of Congress and saying, look, here's something you've told us. Do you really want to see that public as well? So there are many, many angles to what's going on right now. And I think as long as there's time, there is a possibility of a resolution short of taking it to court. That's what's happened when this has come up in the past. There's been delays, talk, more negotiation. The train has not run off the track. And I think that's what people on both sides are working on right now.
And one more question, Gail. At the beginning of the week, there was a sense, a broad sense, by both Republicans and Democrats, both in office and out of office, that this would be the final week on the job for Attorney General Alberto Gonzales, that this controversy and others were going to consume him this week, and that he would either be asked to leave or would resign on his own under pressure. Ironically, as we get toward the end of the week, maybe because of this controversy, and the fact that the White House needs him as a point man at this juncture, he may actually be on the job longer than anyone had speculated at the beginning of the week.
The reports of his political death were premature, it seems. But the other thing I think to look for is whether various Hispanic and Latino groups rally around him. He's making a lot of overtures on that front. It would be a very short term for this first Hispanic attorney general. And I think there are other aspects to this as well, people who want to see him succeed and certainly don't want to see him crashing after so short a tenure.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gail Chadwick spoke to us from Washington. Joining us now in the studio is Lawrence Tribe, professor of constitutional law at Harvard University. Hello, Professor.
Hello, Bob.
I want to ask you to give us your big picture here of the issues that are at issue in this controversy.
Well, I think the big picture relates to the manipulation of the administration of justice. It is true that prosecutors are hired and fired at will by the president, but of 468 U.S. attorneys confirmed by the Senate over the 25 years up to 2006, only 10 left office involuntarily for reasons other than a change in administration. Wholesale removal, as the one that Bill Clinton did when he came in, doesn't threaten manipulation of particular prosecutions. But what happened with David Iglesias and others, though we don't know the truth yet, that's why you need testimony under oath, suggests that there was intervention either to encourage the prosecution of political enemies or to discourage the prosecution of political allies. And invoking executive privilege in this context would be very problematic.
Do you believe that the Bush administration's claim of executive privilege in this case is misguided?
Well, I think it's not frivolous, but I think it is ultimately misguided for several reasons. First of all, there has not been a request by either the House or the Senate, nor is there any in the offing, for testimony bearing on or emails disclosing confidential advice received by the president. And that's the rationale of executive privilege, that people would feel free to give candid advice. What is sought instead is evidence bearing on whether the White House manipulated the course of justice through the office of Attorney General Gonzalez or of D. Kyle Sampson, his chief of staff, as a way of deciding which prosecutors to pull off of which sensitive cases and which to sic on the opposition. Secondly, the claim of executive privilege is very hard to maintain after one has dumped an avalanche of emails with an unexplained gap between, as I understand it, about November 16th and December 7th, just before seven of the eight firings occurred. You can't have your cake and eat it too in that way. Third, the claim of executive privilege that we really need to shield from any outside view advice to the president is inconsistent with the White House offer to let Karl Rove and Harriet Myers and others testify, except with no transcript, not under oath, not in public view, and with no chance to call them back. Now, there is no legitimate interest preserved by the executive privilege in allowing dissembling, allowing incomplete and inaccurate and indeed duplicitous testimony, so that once the president has said, you can find out exactly what was said, but I don't want you to find out by people who are willing to swear that they're telling the truth and willing to have it recorded, he's really not invoking any traditional concept of executive privilege, but rather the privilege not to tell the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It seems to me that that is an abuse of the executive privilege and that Congress would be within its rights to hold the threat of contempt over the head of Karl Rove or Harriet Myers or anyone else who refuses to testify under these circumstances. And I think the courts would be hard-pressed to affirm a claim of executive privilege.
Well, if we were in court at this moment and I was asking you as a witness this question, how would you answer it, yes or no? Is the evidence that's on the table so far in the prosecutor firings powerful enough to overcome executive privilege?
Well, you don't have to overcome executive privilege when there's no executive privilege to overcome. And my first point was that for three separate reasons, the claim of executive privilege is not well-founded. But second, the evidence, I think, is powerful. There's no evidence of criminal wrongdoing. But we have to remember that the context of executive privilege, which comes to us in large part from the landmark case in the Supreme Court of United States v. Nixon, is not all about criminal investigation alone. In United States v. Nixon, the real issue was whether the president's power to fire a prosecutor, in that case, the special prosecutor,
Archibald Cox,
Archibald Cox and Mr. Jaworski after him, encompassed the power to call the shots on how vigorously the prosecutor would go after Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and others. And what the Supreme Court of the United States basically said is that the president's power to decide who prosecutes does not include a power to subvert the course of justice, which is why the Watergate tapes exploded, not because we already had evidence that the president was probably criminally implicated. It seems to me in this case, when we have 8 firings in a period of days of a kind that only had 10 precedents before them in 25 years, and when the 10 prosecutors who had previously been discharged selectively, not upon a change of administration, in nearly every case had given evidence of professional misconduct, we have not quite a smoking gun, but a very hot gun, certainly hot enough to overcome a very dubious claim of executive privilege.
But you would also agree that it's within the president's purview, it's within the administration's purview to replace U.S. attorneys at will.
But that's a red herring. Of course that's within the president's purview. But the power
to replace
at will... But
it's not a red herring for those who argue this politically.
Well, they are using a kind of debater's point, which I think won't withstand analysis. The power to get rid of somebody for no reason is not the power to get rid of them for an impermissible reason, because everyone agrees that the ability to start with a clean slate when you're the new president does not implicate the manipulation of the course of justice in particular cases. That's what's involved here. The greater power does not always include the lesser. The power to kill people on the battlefield doesn't include the power to boil them in oil for a little while. It seems to me that the administration in many areas has suggested because the president is commander-in-chief and has the huge powers that the commander-in-chief wields, that the president can therefore manipulate within very broad areas the right of the public to know the truth about the course of justice.
Let's bring another voice to the conversation now, Douglas Kamek, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University. Hi, professor.
Good morning.
So let me ask you to give us your take on this. What appears to be the White House game plan so far?
Well, I think the White House is defending its prerogatives, not just because it has a personal interest in this particular matter, but because it feels it is important to the defense of the office of the presidency. I greatly respect Professor Tribe, but I have some significant disagreement with him. It is my reading of the cases that presidential communications are presumptively privileged and that the courts have, in fact, defined what a presidential communication to be somewhat broader than what he has suggested. He's absolutely correct that the seminal case in this area is United States versus Nixon. But we also have received more recent guidance from cases that arose in the context of the Clinton administration that were decided by the D.C. Circuit. And they define presidential communications as communications that are either authored by or solicited and received by presidential advisors, and that involve information regarding government operations that ultimately call for a decision by the president. All of the things we're talking about here, Bob, fall within that definition because we are talking about an authority that is very importantly lodged in the president alone, namely the ability to nominate his U.S. attorneys, the ability to appoint them after the advice and consent of the Senate, and most importantly, the ability to remove them. The Supreme Court has said that the power to remove is an essential incident of the power to appoint because it's that potential removal authority by which the president can coordinate and implement his policies, and it's by that means that we legitimately hold presidents accountable for what their subordinates do. But if the president does not have that authority, or if it is interfered with by the Congress, the ability of the executive to undertake responsible governance to take care that the laws are faithfully executed is greatly undermined. So there is a constitutional principle here that the president is defending, and I think rightly so.
Can an argument be made, Professor Kamek, that the White House has already waived executive privilege by the fact that it's given up thousands of pages of emails related to this matter?
Certainly, I think that argument is one that would be of interest should this go to the courts. But as Professor Tribe knows, the most common way in which executive privilege claims are resolved is not in the judiciary, but in negotiation. And so I don't think the president or the White House here can be put into a kind of whipsaw where people are saying he's not interested in allowing the truth to be told and at the same time fault him for allowing that truth to be told by the disclosure of information. The 3,000 pages or so of materials that have been distributed are really his offer of the truth, his offer of a complete accommodation of the interests of the legislature. And what is the interest of the legislature? It is the legitimate interest in knowing that the laws have been faithfully executed, that there has not been an obstruction of justice, that in fact no one has specifically interfered with a particular prosecution, and that all that has occurred here is, you can debate whether it was the right personnel decision or not, but basically a personnel decision in terms of the president seeking to have the control and oversight of the people who work for him. So, Bob, I think the release of the information is an example of the president cooperating with the legislature, showing them respect, and I don't think he loses all ability to protect the parameters of his office by virtue of that offer of cooperation.
Are you surprised, Professor, at how quickly this issue has come to a crisis point?
Well, I think the partisanship that we have seen is very unfortunate. I think it is an aspect of other matters. I think the Judiciary Committee has had other disputes with the Attorney General. I think to some degree they saw this as an opportunity to take him to task because they were unhappy with him with respect to his decisions regarding the war on terror and the terrorist surveillance program and his defense of the president's initiatives in that respect. But I think one of the other things that has caused this to come to a boil so quickly is that when you have these disputes, there's normally a long process of haggling, of back and forth on the terms of how the accommodation will be arrived at. And instead, we had a letter prepared by the White House counsel, Mr. Fielding, which in good faith really comprehensively dealt with all of the aspects of how the information could be provided to the Hill. It normally would have taken weeks for that to have been ironed out. This expert attorney got it done in a day, in an afternoon. It was sort of like going to a car dealer and getting the no-haggle price. And as a result, it brought it to a boil or a decision point much more quickly than if you had less experienced people involved.
Professor Tribe, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, I guess perhaps the reason it reached the no-haggle point so quickly is that many people in Congress were beginning to worry that they were dealing with a used car salesman mentality rather than justice. The interest here is not only in making sure that there's no obstruction of justice, though that's certainly part of it. It's also in making sure that the legislative branch can meaningfully exercise its power of oversight, which has been lacking until recently, so that when one gets lots of information, but some of it is demonstrably mistaken or incomplete, there is an independent constitutional interest on the part of the legislature in having the testimony under oath. And to say that the selective release of thousands of emails somehow satisfies that interest is unfortunately reminiscent of the days when President Nixon had a pile of tapes saying, this is the whole truth. But of course, to get the whole truth, sometimes one needs the pressure of the subpoena. And I think here there has been a waiver of any legitimate interest, especially since I haven't heard Doug, whom I also respect enormously and like, but I haven't heard Doug Kmiec explain what the interest is in offering the testimony, but with a wink, not under oath, not with a transcript, not with the ability to call people back.
Well, why don't we let Professor Kmiec comment on that?
Well, I think the interest is the one that has historically existed with respect to the White House staff. As Professor Tribe knows, it is extraordinary to have the White House staff testify before Congress. It has been done, but in virtually all of the cases in which it has been done, the interest in having that testimony related to very specific, far more specific than what we have here, allegations of misconduct. So there were a dozen or so, maybe more, Clinton White House officials who testified because there were grand jury investigations of Whitewater matters. There were grand jury investigations of failed savings and loans. There were grand jury investigations of various improprieties with respect to personnel within the White House. There were White House personnel who testified in Watergate, largely because there had been criminal activity in terms of the break-in itself and then the serious concern that there was a cover-up of those who had authorized that break-in with respect to the Democratic headquarters. And you, without those examples, the general principle is that the president gets to have a staff that advises him and can advise him with candor and openness without being fearful that they are going to be required to disclose their advice on the front pages of the Washington Post as a result of a testimony in public on Capitol Hill. That is, I think, a very important principle to preserve.
We're talking about the escalating confrontation between Congress and the president, the political theater, the legal battle, what it all means. Our in-studio guest is Lawrence Tribe of Harvard. Douglas Kmiec of Pepperdine University is also joining us from California. And right now we go to the phones. Don is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Don.
Hi, Bob. Thanks a lot for taking my call. Fascinating show. And I guess my take on it is this, is for about the last 6 years, we have not really seen the checks and balances that the founding fathers tried to set in. We've got the legislature, we have the executive branch, and really the judiciary are the people that are supposed to say when things have gotten out of hand. I personally believe the administration has in many times stepped over the executive privilege bounds, and unfortunately for 6 years we haven't had a Congress that was able to do anything about it. Now we do, and I say let's bring it to the Supreme Court and see what they think.
Professor Kmiec, go ahead.
Don's plea in favor of checks and balances is a good one, is a sound one. We separated the powers largely to prevent tyranny. But not every question in our constitutional system is resolved by the courts. And in this particular area, the court has largely said this is an area to be worked out between the political branches. When the courts have stepped in, they have largely vindicated the position that President Bush has taken. For example, in the Watergate era, when a Senate committee asked for and subpoenaed particular information from President Nixon, in the Senate Select Committee case, the D.C. Circuit found that there had not been an adequate showing of legislative need. In U.S. versus Nixon, as President Tribe alluded to, President Nixon, of course, lost on that particular assertion of privilege because there was a demonstrable need on behalf of certain criminal defendants for the information that the president was withholding. And here's where the court case gets resolved. There's two issues. Is there a presidential communication to which the privilege applies? I think there is. Professor Tribe disputes that. The second issue, which is also very important, is there a demonstrable legislative need? And Bob, where is the legislative need here? Because the only thing that's on the table is basically the issue that the president has exercised his usual authority of supervising subordinate officers and that politics, to some degree, is a factor in the exercise of a political appointment. There's nothing else that has been shown to be seriously an issue, and by virtue of that, there is no demonstrable legislative need for the court to vindicate. So with all due respect to Don, I don't think the court would take this case, or if it did take the case, would resolve it favorably for the legislature.
Professor Kamek, Professor Tribe is shaking his head a little bit here. Let's hear what he has to say.
Well, I think there are several clear legislative needs. Congress is, in fact, considering whether to change the rules that were put in place very recently at the request of the Bush administration to permit the president to put prosecutors in place without Senate confirmation, supposedly to help fight the war on terror. We now learn that the reasons may have been different. Secondly, there is a legislative need to make sure that Congress isn't lied to and deceived by the administration. And third, it's important to recognize that in the classic and only major Supreme Court case that really addresses this, the need was not, contrary, I'm afraid, to what Professor Kamek said, on behalf of criminal defendants. It was the prosecutor. It was Mr. Jaworski and before him, Mr. Cox, who wanted the Watergate tapes in order to prosecute certain presidential aides. Those aides would have been entirely happy not to have the evidence introduced. The question was whether the president's ability to fire the prosecutor, as he did once in the famous Saturday Night Massacre, included the ability to decide on his own, without judicial intervention, just what information should be seen by the public and by the courts and what shouldn't be. Remember the famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap? Well, now there's a gap of well over a week or two in the emails that are being produced. And I think the courts are likely to decide that in this instance, as in others, the president is not above the law, and the decision of what information the Congress is entitled to, if we do come to an impasse, will have to be made by a neutral arbiter.
The debate over this issue has the on-point listeners stacking up with phone calls. Let's go back to the phones. Paul is calling from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for taking my call. Listen to your program all the time. Myself, I don't think it's all that important. Seems like it's every time you turn around, the Democratic Party is, and the mainstream media is trying to find something against Bush. I mean, the White House, every time you turn around. And, you know, Clinton fired 93 justices. So, I mean, if he's got that right and has that authority, what about this? What if the Democratic Party proposes immunity to the witnesses? Would that help out?
Professor Tribe, why don't we let you take that? Is it possible at this point to negotiate something with the White House that might include immunity for the witnesses that would be acceptable to the Democrats and the White House, do you think? What's the possibility of a compromise here?
Well, I very much hope some compromise can be worked out, but I think promising Karl Rove or promising Harriet Myers that they won't be prosecuted based on their answers, which is what an immunity promise is all about, would be essentially answering a question they haven't asked. They're not taking the Fifth. They are saying, and the president is really saying on their behalf, that presidential communications, very broadly defined, as Professor Kamek has tried to define them, are on behalf of the national interest and behalf of the office of the president, things that ought to be withheld from Congress, except, and here's where a contradiction enters, they're quite willing to let Congress hear what was said as long as they don't have to promise to be telling the truth, and as long as no one gets to write it down, as long as they don't get called back. I don't think immunity will solve the problem.
Well, let me ask the question in another way. Is there an absolute need for these White House aides or officials to be under oath if they testify? If the testimony is on the record, does it need to be under oath?
Absolutely. Under oath simply means I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. How can it possibly be objectionable that they're promising to tell the truth?
Well, what's the possible compromise then?
Frankly, I don't know. I mean, perhaps under oath, but in executive session. Perhaps under oath with some time limit, not being called back more than twice. I really don't know. I haven't looked at it. It certainly isn't the road to compromise. To say, as the White House has said, it's our way or the highway. We will not consider anything else. And the moment you put your proposal on the table of subpoena under oath and with a transcript, we pull our marbles out and go home. It seems to me that whatever negotiation takes place, it has to take place in sort of under the shadow of the law and in recognition that neither side is allowed to say that you have to play the game exactly our way and we won't talk with you once you've made a counterproposal.
Professor Kimek, you want to take a shot at a possible compromise?
Well, first of all, on the issue of oath, the legislative council has already pointed out that it is possible to prosecute someone for lying to Congress even when they're not under oath. So to some degree, I think that is a red herring. On the issue of the caller's question as to, you know, what's going on here, I think that's a very legitimate concern because this looks, you know, from the executive side as merely an opportunity to create embarrassment rather than to actually address any specific legislative need because I don't think there has been any serious showing that the president has tried to manipulate the process or the attorney general has tried to manipulate the process. The heart of this case still is that the president exercised supervision over his subordinate officers. He had a variety of reasons for doing so. The papers that have been disgorged demonstrate that there were complaints from Democratic members of Congress about these individual prosecutors, that there were complaints from Democratic appointed judges. And in fact, in today's Los Angeles Times, there's a story indicating that one of the fired prosecutors, Kevin Ryan in San Francisco, was sought to be protected by a Republican donor in order to keep his job, so that the complaints were coming from the Democratic side about his performance and the Republicans were trying to keep him. So, you know, the whole story with respect to the Democratic allegation just simply doesn't hold together, and therefore there's no legislative need, and therefore the opportunity for compromise beyond the very generous offer that has been made by Mr. Fielding seems very small. I'll just hold one out, not that I'm recommending this, but it seems to me that a transcript is possible that would be prepared solely for internal use. That is, if they had these discussions at the White House and there was some subsequent dispute as to who said what, this transcript could be kept in reserve and it would not be made publicly available unless there was a credible dispute that that in fact arose. I think there might be some room for compromise there. I think the White House would have reason to resist that only because, again, since there's no legitimate basis to undertake this entire investigation, there is no additional basis to make it look like a trial when, in fact, a trial is wholly inappropriate.
Professor Larry Tribe of Harvard University, is a transcript enough?
I don't think it is, but I think I want to reflect on one fundamental point, and that is, for reasons that are understandable and not partisan, Democrats and Republicans have begun to lose confidence in the processes of justice and in an attorney general who really leaves people very much up in the air about whether justice is being manipulated, whether the FBI's use of security letters is being underreported. It seems to me that doing this in the dark and doing it in a way that does not encourage transparency can only exacerbate the confusion that Professor Kmiak points to. We don't know exactly who was trying to pull what strings, but there is plenty of smoke here, more than enough, to see whether there is any fire.
Harriet's calling from Grinnell, Iowa. Hi, Harriet, and thanks for calling.
Hello, Bob. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I am so deeply disturbed by Professor Kinect's stance on all of this. I believe that my interest as a citizen and all of our interest is to have as much openness in government as possible, and I'm just dismayed that you are advocating that so much secrecy would be a reasonable or desirable thing. For me, the best response to all of this would be for the president to back down and to send his people voluntarily to speak under oath. But, boy, I'd like there to be a transcript. Boy, I would like them to be sworn to speak under oath. This reminds me of the Watergate days and Doonesbury cartoons where Doonesbury depicted the stone wall going up around the White House. And then after the president resigned and President Ford was inaugurated, the wall was chopped down and the sun shone again over the seat of government. And that's what I would like to see here.
Harriet, hang on. Let's get Doug Kmiak to respond. Professor Kmiak, you have to be kind of short. We're coming to the end of the program.
I think Harriet's position is the easiest one to defend. Openness is always an easy answer in a democratic system, and usually a good answer. But sometimes it's not the right answer because there are aspects of the separation of powers that need to be observed. And the two that I think I would just hold out to Harriet are the ability of the president to get confidential advice, and second, insofar as these discussions would inevitably deal with the topics of what prosecution was brought and where, the discussion of those prosecutions in a public manner would be jeopardizing as well, in the same way that we don't want Senator Domenici or others to be calling to influence the outcome of prosecutions. We don't want pressure from Congress to ultimately be used to influence them either. I think both interests are at stake.
Professor Kmiak, thank you. Professor Tribe, last word.
Well, I think that on balance, as some have said, sunshine is the best disinfectant, and we could use some.
Professor Lawrence Tribe, constitutional expert from Lawrence Law, from Harvard Law, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Bob.
Professor Doug Kmiak, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, thanks a lot.
Bob, good to be with you.
I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.